Well, I want to first of all say thank you to Pastor Hayes and thank you to church family and friends and my colleagues for allowing us to come out tonight and talk with you about some of the things that we do on a day-to-day basis. I had the honor and privilege of meeting Pastor Hayes probably about 4 or 5 months ago, and we had an instant connection, and one of the things he wanted our team to do was to come on site to your church and talk about hospice services. He said that he feels very passionate about it. He understands there's a need for it. But Charlie, there's a lot of folks that just, they don't understand it. They don't get it. They don't know what the benefits are. They don't know how to pay for it, different things like that. So as he said, I kind of brought my entourage, everybody wave, with me. They just so happen to be all ladies, I promise. I didn't plan that. I'm very fortunate. But no, we have a great team, and you know, part of my job as a community outreach specialist with Franciscan VNS St. Francis Hospice, I know that's one big long name, is to make sure that I coordinate education about hospice care. You know, we're not going to get people that are going to elect to use this benefit or sign up for it if they don't know what it is. So if you don't walk away with anything here tonight, we want to make sure that we inform you of those things. We do have an agenda. If you had a chance to see the flyer that had gone out, you know, we had some very basic things on there. You know, what is hospice? How are you eligible? How do you pay for it? What does it cover? Where do you deliver your services? And those are the questions that we want to answer tonight. But when you came in, you got a really nice and neat, fresh off the press notepad, right? Does everybody have your notepad? Okay. Now, and you got a pen, right? Okay. So what I want you to do is to just take a few moments, and we're going to get started, but just jot some questions down that you may have. It may be about an experience that you've had with hospice. It may have been a burning question that you want to know in the last 10, 20, 30 years. We may not get everything answered in the next 90 minutes, but we want to make sure that we try. Okay? Okay. So like I said, you got your notepads, you have your pens. Go ahead and write down, you know, maybe one or two questions, and then we'll want to make sure that we'll get those answered. We got several things that we do want to address. Before I go any further, I want to go back to my team and make sure I introduce them. The lady that you see passing around some things, this is Adrian. She's one of our triage nurses. Carla Norton in the front row, she's one of our chaplains, and she's on our bereavement team. Cheryl McMahon, she's our director of volunteers. And Sarah Tony is one of our home health aides. Now, Carla's going to come up after me and kind of go into more detail about those positions to explain to you what our team kind of looks like. I know when people kind of think hospice first, they think, oh, there's a nurse and there's a physician. But, you know, there's a whole team of people that works with that patient and family. So we want to make sure we deliver that message to you as well. Okay? So let's start off by doing this. I want to make sure I got to include both sides of the room. So just one or two volunteers. Who can tell me what hospice means to them? What is hospice to you? What is it? You don't know? So go ahead, say it again so everybody can hear.
When you get really sick, they cut hospice in.
Okay. Who else?
In-home service by a professional staff.
Okay.
To take care of the ill person.
Okay. Anybody else want to take a stab at it?
Yeah.
All right.
Is there a certain age limit or a physical condition limit in the hospice to get someone to come to your home and take care of you about the age or maybe physically, mentally, or whatever?
Okay. Now, I don't want to make sure I don't want to miss anybody.
I'm not really being fair, but it's end-of-life care.
Okay. Now, you're probably wondering why I asked that question. You're like, well, Charlie, you here, you brought your team. You're not supposed to be asking us questions. You're supposed to be telling us what it is. It's always helpful to kind of take a quick poll in the room and see where people are. You know, this is a specialty service. It's really not like anything else in healthcare that you're going to see or that you're going to experience. So it's always good to find out what people know and what they don't know which will help us guide our conversation. Now, before I actually get into the quick definition of what hospice is, I want to go over real quick advanced directives. Just by a quick show of hand, who's ever heard of that before? Who in here has or believe they have some type of advanced directive? That's good. A lot of times I go and I speak places and nobody raises their hand or they have no clue what it is. Now, that advanced directives is something that could take, oh God, a whole day in itself. But one of the reasons why I wanted to bring it up is because really before we start talking about hospice and what it is, you have to have done some type of planning with your family. Have some type of conversation to talk about your wishes. When it comes to life-prolonging procedures, what do you want? What don't you want? My wife and I, we talk about it at least once a year, if not more. I think she loves me and she wants to keep me around a little bit longer, but we'll see. But she was very surprised when I told her, I said, hey, you know, I want to be cremated. She said, well, 2 years ago, you didn't say that. I said, yeah, well, you know, that answer is coming from me just knowing a little bit more about it and thinking about the cost. And, you know, instead of you spending a lot of money to have a big fancy funeral for me or the burial and all of that, I'd rather you give that to the kids or to the grandkids or something. But the point I'm getting at is that even in your own household, that decision is going to be different. So even before we get into the meat of this, I wanted to make sure I brought that up. And there were some handouts outside about that as well. A nice little packet from the state of Indiana that kind of explains the different type of advanced directives. And again, I didn't want to overwhelm you with information, but I wanted to give you some, kind of wet your palate a little bit and let you know that we're a resource so that if you want to know more information that you can. Okay? But advanced directives are very important. Now, once you've had that conversation, it makes the topic of hospice a little bit easier. When you have someone that you've designated as a healthcare representative to help you make decisions, or a healthcare power of attorney in case you can't make decisions for yourself. But if I had to put it in its most simplest terms, hospice is providing compassionate care to those that are experiencing a life-limiting illness. And some people are okay with that life-limiting illness part, and some people are not. Can I pick on church people for a minute, please? A lot of times when I'm talking to church folks like us, you know, they say, I'm not worried about it. God's going to take care of me. God's going to solve everything. God's going to heal and fix everything. Well, we're in church, and we all know that God is a very loving God, right? A very loving God. But we're in situations that we just have to deal with. It doesn't mean that God is punishing us or our family in any kind of way. But there are going to be things that come up in our life, and we have to make sure that we're educated on what to do step by step. So as our team, our wonderful Franciscan VNS team, we want to make sure that we're delivering that compassionate care every single day. There are some patients on our service that start, and 3-4 months later, they're doing better. They don't need hospice any longer. One of the reasons why Adrian is here as an RN to kind of explain to you the reason why sometimes that happens. And the reason why I want to say that and be upfront is because it's a hard thing to talk about, but I want people to understand that it doesn't mean you're giving up. It doesn't. There is an essence of curative treatment, and when you're electing a benefit like hospice, you are talking to your physician and talking to your family, or you're making the decision to say, in very simple terms, again, we're not going to do anything aggressive. But there's a difference between aggressive and saying I'm giving up. And we want to make sure that we're here with you to hold your hand during that process. That makes sense so far? Okay. So my friend Kayla's in the back got a button that she's going to hit if I start to talk too much, because she knows me very well and she knows I do that sometimes. How many history buffs do we have in the room? Raise your hand if you love history. Okay, so most people are like me, don't like history at all. I slept through history class, but I still graduated, I did. I just want to give you a quick history lesson. This may be something you know, it may be something you don't know, but you know, when I read this for the first time years ago, I was like, wow, I didn't know that. How did hospice get started? Years and years ago, early days of Christianity,
It was a place service for weary travelers, for those people to come that were dying. As time went on, just like with everything else, medicine started to change, and the idea of hospice kind of broadened a little bit and said, well, hey, maybe we can help these people before they actually are tired and they get to this point. And now when we look at 2014, medicine has changed so much, our service has changed so much that, again, we want to make sure we hold your hands through this process, but we can actually begin to work with that patient and that family very early on so that they can have some level of comfort, so they can have a quality of life. And I just like to share that with folks because, again, maybe it kind of helps you when you think hospice and you think in your mind, oh, this is not a bad thing. Well, early on, just like with everything else, when things first come out, you don't trust it, you don't know about it, you hear bad things about it from somebody across the street, from your neighbor, you don't want to go see that movie, you don't want to go to that restaurant. And even if they change, even if they start to have better food, start to have different service, maybe you still don't experience it. And when you talk to someone else about it, you say, uh-uh, don't go there, it's not good. That's kind of the same thing that's happened with our service. And we take that a little personal. We don't really like it because we want people to know, hey, it's really not that kind of party. Maybe it was like that years ago, but things have changed now. So with that being said, this is a great segue into what our team looks like. And I'm going to have Miss Carla come up and talk to you about our team. And then after that, our good friend Adrian is going to go into some of the more specifics about how do you qualify, what qualifies you, where can you get these services at, and that sort of thing. Okay?
And I will be brief. But today we had a staff meeting, and we just happened to take a picture. So I'm going to pass. We're missing probably 7 or 8 of us in that, but this is us. And some of us are here. You can just pass it around. And a significant part of hospice, and those of you that are familiar, and certainly Nancy is, with Joe being in our care for just a short time, and Pastor Hayes introducing us to you, part of the team is a significant reason why hospice works. It, of course, is very important that we have the medical part, but the rest of the team, too. I want to just briefly go over that, and then we'll have time for questions and answers afterwards, toward the end. But part of that team is what I do, is a chaplain, and we have 4 chaplains, 2 that work direct care with our patients and families, or people in our families, before they do step into heaven, and the other group are 2 of us work in bereavement full-time. And toward the end, I want to tell you a little bit more about chaplaincy, especially since we're here at Heather Hills Baptist Church. But we start off with our medical director, and he have 2 additional physicians that work with him. So you have a physician on call 24 hours a day, and then we have our nurses, and Adrian is our triage nurse, whom I'm able to listen to almost every day when I'm in the office, as she introduces people to hospice, really, before we go out and do the legal paperwork and get people signed up to begin that care. Adrian speaks to our families that are wondering, what is hospice? Similar to what Charlie shared just a little while ago, but they have medical questions, probably the number one thing, and she'll go into that. But after that, we have a whole group of nurses that are significantly trained in end-of-life care. And Mrs. Hayes, as you probably all know, worked with hospice for many years with VistaCare. And our nurses are unique in the fact that a hospice nurse has to have a special something about him or her, because they're not curing. They're dealing with issues, end-of-life and comfort, and making those days or weeks or months or hopefully even more than that comfortable working with our physicians. And then we have our aides, our hospice home health aides, and Sarah has been in hospice how many years? 35 years working with families and people that are in hospice, and everyone loves her. So Sarah is representing our hospice aides, and our volunteers are a significant part of hospice, a part of the team, and Cheryl McMahon is our coordinator. I'm not sure how many volunteers we use in bereavement, but I think 12, 15, or something like that, that we could not do bereavement without them. They go through a training, and some of you may be interested in that, have to be at least a year away from the death of a significant person in their lives, and they are all gone through criminal checks and training through that. Then after that, we have our social workers who deal with, as you would maybe guess, some of the advanced directives issues that Charlie mentioned, because there's a lot of questions about end of life and how you actually get those filled out, funeral arrangements, things like that. And then they also help with our chaplains and our nurses in bereavement, because that grief has already started before their loved, as you would know, before their loved ones actually leave us here. There's many things that are social workers, and neither one could be here tonight, and then the chaplains. And I just say briefly, since we're in this particular group, I get this question a lot one-on-one, but not so much in a group, and I'm just going to be brave enough to go ahead and say it. You may be thinking, okay, as a chaplain, are you able to introduce or help someone find their faith in Jesus before they die? The answer is yes. Absolutely. We walk beside each of these dear people, but the questions that they bring to us, and so many times we find the most a myriad amount of questions as a chaplain, spiritual issues. And maybe they went to Sunday school when they were four and then never went back to church again. And end of life is when I think 98.5% of people want to deal with their spiritual health at that point. And, you know, am I going to go to heaven? What's heaven all about? We get a lot of those questions. It's a great, big, wonderful team, and I just don't want to leave out our office people, too, that work tirelessly. Some of the people in the picture are the ladies that work in our office.
Now, I do much better when I am speaking with people one-on-one, so I appreciate that you've come out tonight, and I will do the best I can to address you as a group, because what I've come to see lately is that I can't speak to 30 or 40 people a day and give them the time and attention that they need to have their questions answered. And I actually wanted to start, when you responded, sir, when Charlie was asking, was that a question that you had?
Was that what?
Was it a question that you had about having care in the home at a particular age? It struck me that you were asking a question, and I thought, I wondered about that, and I wrote it down, and you expressed, you know, is there an age limit? Were you kind of trying to get at what type of services would be available or when you would be eligible for that?
When would you be eligible? What condition would you have to be in before you'd be eligible? Did it make any difference about age?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But what about that? Age.
And that's a very good question.
I also threw mentally in there, but I didn't know if that was actually, if I really meant that or not. But I did mean the age.
Yes.
Yes.
And I wondered about that, and I can maybe speak to it a little bit. I don't know that I have the best answer for you. And we're kind of digressing to start off, because I heard him say that, and I wanted to kind of be able to respond. It isn't necessarily your age, nor is it in any one way what your mental status is. Your eligibility for hospice is based on whether or not, given your health condition, we could say there is a terminal illness in place. And so for folks that we look after, a terminal illness means more than likely, if a disease progresses the way it's expected without treatment, and oftentimes the disease processes we are dealing with, there are no more curative treatments. So if it progresses as expected, a terminal diagnosis would mean 6 months or less to live. And what we see and what we seek to do is educate people about the fact that that does not mean if you become our patient, you're going to be with us 6 months or less. That is what we have to document to be able to say to Medicare, which is one of the primary insurances, that this person is eligible to receive our services, depending on the diagnosis.
One reason I ask that, I have a grandson who had, at five, he was almost six, he had neuroblastoma cancer, and he lived in Michigan. And the doctors first gave him 10% chance of survival, and that he had cancer everywhere in his bone marrow, and he had a big thing on his kidney, and he was only 6 years old, and they had given him up. Well, that's the reason I ask that. But he's 22 or 3 now, and he graduated from college in Indiana Wesleyan. But that was one reason I asked. Could they have had hospice come in? Of course, my daughter had to do a lot of the work after they brought him home.
Sure.
You know.
No, and again, one of the conditions for being a hospice patient is that you're either of your own cognizance decided you're done with active treatment or there really is no further active treatment. And for your grandson, obviously there was still treatment to be had and his parents pursued it and they had a good outcome. What we look at is in our patient population, and more often than not, when you're talking about active treatment, we're looking at the cancer diagnosis. And is there still a particular type of chemotherapy that would be beneficial? Many people do as much as they can for as long as they can, and then, you know, they quickly start to realize that the cure is often as debilitating as the disease, and it's their decision to not do that. And they want to go home, and they want to enjoy the time that they have available to them. So that's what we're there for. Yeah. And so I wanted to address that. And then I have to go back to my little sheet because I am, again, not a public speaker. So I need to have points in front of me. We just kind of talked about who is eligible, and hospice benefit says terminal diagnosis of more than likely 6 months or less. And depending on that diagnosis, it really can be iffy. As I said, with our cancer patients, a lot of times more than likely that is an expectation. With our folks that have end-stage lung disease and are oxygen dependent, they have coped for a very long time, and they're very used to that, and they maintain very well. And we're able to come in and do a little bit of symptom management with medication, and those folks can be on service much longer than 6 months. And, you know, that's kind of our goal. In order to keep people on service, we just need to be able to document from our visits that, yes, they're doing better or they're maintaining, but there is still a functional decline. And that's similar also for things like congestive heart failure. Some of the other things you'll see as hospice diagnosis are things like neurological disorders. Lou Gehrig's disease is one of them. And, you know, there are things like liver failure, renal disease. And, again, we look at each individual that comes to us and says, you know, what's going on? Where are they at functionally? Because it really depends on how functional a person is, if they're eligible to be in our program. And, unfortunately, a lot of times we bring people in for a very short period of time. And sometimes that's as little as a couple of days because they have sought out the emergency room treatment situation so many times, and no one's ever taken the opportunity to have a heart-to-heart with them about why this is maybe not going to be the best case scenario. And then we get them and we bring them home, and that is the end of their life. That is not our goal. Our goal would be to have people in service as long as we possibly can to maximize, you know, their comfort and their symptom management and their quality. And, you know, those are good relationships, right? And that's kind of what we hope to do. We, you know, it is a service, but the people that are caring for you, it's a life work. And, you know, that is our goal, is to promote quality of life. And I'm going to refer to my sheet again. And if you get tired of listening, feel free to ask a question. You know, one of the handout information pieces is, what is hospice? And, you know, hospice is really a concept of care. It is not a place per se. It is partnering with patients and families to provide them with the medications, the education, the durable medical equipment that they might need to make caring for a loved one doable in their home. And really, it's a philosophy. There is talk of palliative care. Palliative care is talking about symptom management versus aggressive treatment, and looking at, if someone's short of breath, we're going to treat, you know, what's causing the shortness of breath if we can, and that really depends on the patient. So for a heart failure patient, we're going to look at the medicines that give their heart muscle the best contractility, gives them the best cardiac output, and we're going to have other medicines in place that, should they have an exacerbation and their normal meds aren't working, we can medicate them. And I'll go into more of that in a little bit, because it's not hard for me to get off on a tangent, unfortunately. And so, you know, as far as, you know, what hospice is, we want to talk to folks about understanding why we are encouraging them not to always go with the most aggressive treatment. Because honestly, what we see is that aggressive treatment, a lot of times at end of life, can actually shorten the time period that people are with us. Because it is such a stressor to go through, you know, the trip to the emergency room, the possible resuscitation or near resuscitation, the intubation, the weaning from the ventilator. You know, these are really serious things. And I think in our culture, we start to take them for granted because we're quite comfortable with it. And here's my next tangent. Your nursing staff are majority critical care nurse background. So we've been in this scenario, we know it very well, and we left it because what we saw was that there are a lot of things you can do to people that doesn't necessarily make their lives better. And in the hospital scenario, unfortunately, nursing is geared to patient care, managing machines, and families don't really have much input or teaching or anything else, because there's no real place in that world to document what you're doing with a family. And that's what we're accountable for. And many of us decided that we wanted to go out into people's homes, make them comfortable. I will tell you, having been a triage nurse for St. Vincent 6 years before I came to St. Francis, the majority of the time I spent was with family members, because it's very easy to get your loved ones under control and comfortable, and then the focus needs to go to those people that are actually doing the care. And in hospice, as I say, it's a concept. We are partnering with patients and families to do care. Your hospice Medicare benefit, which the majority of our patients utilize, says that there is a primary caregiver in place. A lot of times that is a spouse of similar age. Sometimes it's friends that have stepped up to take on that role. And it puts into place the hospice plan. And, you know, when I say we partner, we put things in your home that help you take care of your loved ones. We get medical equipment. We get medications. You have nursing visits, but we visit. We don't staff. We're not there doing the primary care. We have home health aides that come and visit and give baths. And we look at providing visits according to our patient's needs. So if our patient is comfortable, and that is our goal, and their symptoms are managed, they may need to be seen once a week. They may need to be seen twice a week. And what we do is establish that as a baseline and then increase the frequency that we come to people's homes based on need. Another part of hospice, and we function under regulations. So to participate as a hospice, we're accountable. One of the things is we always have to have nursing available to speak to people. So a lot of times people hear you have 24-hour nursing. Well, you do. You have support. That does not mean that we're in your home 24 hours at a time, but that we're always available. And one of the biggest things about being successful is that our families are willing to call, get on the phone, and talk with us. This is what's happening. This is what I'm seeing. I really need you to come. And my first response is, you're right, we will come. Let's talk about what you can do based on what we've already put in place to make this manageable until I can get there. Because realistically, I could be 30 minutes away. And there's a big piece that could be handled within the home, which is why we have those medicines there by family members. And as is often the case, there's a crisis, we give direction for medicine, and we send the nurse, and the situation is usually resolved a lot of times by the time we get there. And that's usually the greatest hope. If it's not, and this kind of goes into, you know, different levels of care that are available. As I said, we're not staffing you, but in hospice care, there are different levels of care. Home care is the primary, and home being a private residence or an extended care facility. There is something called a respite benefit, and people who elect their hospice benefit are entitled to a 5-day respite stay periodically throughout their hospice experience, and that is designed and really encouraged because it's there to support the caregivers. Because what Medicare recognizes is that folks aren't coming into the hospital for their care. They're being cared for at home. But let's put something in place so that caregivers who really are devoting their life to 24/7 care of a loved one might need a break. And so that's in place. And so that's part of the benefit. There's something called continuous care. And when I say, you know, to you, hospice doesn't come out and staff you, depending on the situation, if there's a crisis, we're in your home with you until the crisis is resolved. And so what can happen is we're either there until that crisis is resolved, or typically what happens is that that patient usually has to be admitted to some type of acute care setting. And I think a lot of times people are confused about, you know, well, when you come to hospice, you're saying, I don't want to go back to the hospital. Under certain circumstances, our patients need to go back to the hospital for symptom management that we can't get under control in the home. And part of that benefit is you have the ability. Now, that's not you call me and say, I need to go to the hospital. That's, you know, you call and say, this is what's going on. The nurse comes out, does an evaluation, talks to the medical director, and we don't think we can get it under control in the home, then our alternative is to hospitalize. And then knowing that, you know, in order for our patient to be discharged, we have to manage whatever was out of control, and then they're going to go home after that. So, again, not hard for me to get off topic. I'm just kind of going with flow of thought. So I'm going to look at my list and see what's next. One of the notes on the itinerary is when care begins, and I think I already touched on that, and having a diagnosis that would say 6 months or less. And if questions come up later, I'll be happy to, you know, answer anything more specifically. You know, and I think I've talked about where it's where hospice care is delivered. One of the thoughts about tonight, you know, how to start hospice. We work under doctor's orders. In order for us to come and speak to you, you could call and ask, and I can send someone out to give you information. What I can't do is actually have you sign consents that you would like to be in our program. I need a doctor's order for that. That generally comes from your primary care physician. And if it's not your primary care physician, if you've been hospitalized for a concern and the doctor discharging you from the hospital thinks that this might be appropriate, I will get a what they call a referral, but I'll be sent your name and history and said, you know, could you come and speak to these people? And really, you know, we're happy to come out and talk to people and give information, and we do that. And what we're looking at is there a health history that more than likely, you know, you would be eligible. It's not, and you know, it's not fail-safe. We bring people on service that do very well, maybe had a point in their life where they weren't doing very well and they had kind of declined. And one of the pluses of hospice, I feel, is like we bring them on service, they stabilize, and we have to discharge. So that does happen to our patients sometimes. We really try and avoid those situations because it's hard to be providing service and then to take that away because you know, people come to rely on us. But that is a possibility. And that just speaks to us being able to say with some kind of credibility that, yes, you are sick enough to need us. And if we can't do that, we can't keep you on service. So I think that answers that. And I think I pretty much said when care begins. And so the only other thing, I guess one of the questions was maybe about how it's paid for. And I've sort of touched on that without, you know, specifically saying. Most people elect their hospice Medicare benefit. Medicaid also has a hospice benefit. Private insurances usually follow very similar guidelines to what Medicare has. The only difference with private insurances is that, you know, in selecting a hospice, you want to find out if that hospice is in network with your insurance, no different than you would, you know, a regular provider. You want them to be in network. Also, you know, we at St. Francis, we have compassionate care. People that come to us without insurance are brought on service. You know, payment is not a necessity, and you know that is part of our organization values, but for the most part this is something that's valued within our culture, and truly, you know, the push is to educate, because as our population ages, you know, more and more people would benefit, and maybe mainstream hasn't kind of caught up to the idea that hospice might be a good thing. Because really, we don't so much promote it as end of life. I'm looking at it from what would be dignified, what would be good symptom management, what would give people the greatest quality. And if that means I'm setting my patient up who doesn't breathe very well with a whole lot of oxygen so she can go grocery shopping and that pleases her, you know, that's the whole goal. Do I have any questions? Because I'm sure I could continue on, but I don't want to. Yes, sir, what can I tell?
Well, you mentioned about the cost of it and the, yes, private health insurance, and about how much is funded by private and how much is going on the government, the general cost. like, of all your patients? Is 50% paid for by Medicare, or?
No, I would say the greater majority is Medicare. I would say, for the most part, our majority of patients are Medicare patients, yes.
Okay.
Medicare or Medicaid. And typically with Medicaid, thank you, with Medicaid, you know, a lot of people that are younger than Medicare age that have Medicaid, it is because of some type of long-term disability. And, you know, that kind of speaks to their health history, right? And so those people are probably more prone to need that benefit.
Well, I guess along that line, you've already not hinted, but certain the guidelines, like
yes.
till the last 6 months, tries to minimize the cost of that, because with the budget being trillions of dollars over budget, this is coming out of the public purse then, a lot of this. So
I'm not sure what the question is, though. I mean, if most I'd like to address
if that. Most of it's paid by Medicaid,
Medicare, yes,
then but just what are the cost constraints on this? Or
you mean, did they limit us?
Yeah.
Or are we limited in our?
Do they evaluate the cost of it? Because.
Well, okay, I can maybe
the cost
to
the government, because we're, whatever, trillions of dollars in debt.
Sure, and you know that's not going to go away. And I'm not certain I can completely address it, but I have an idea. It is less expensive to be looked after at home than it is in an intensive care unit. So, yes, they're looking to all nurses, not only hospice nurses, to educate people as to why those are maybe not the best choices to be making. And it has nothing to do with being a simple financial matter. It has to do with, you know, what are we really promoting in terms of longevity and quality of life, and are we actually promoting suffering by telling people that they should access those kind of services? What is the benefit? And there are hugely costly things that can be done. And again, I go back to the fact I worked in an intensive care for a long time. We would have elderly people. We would have elderly people that couldn't speak for themselves, and they could not come off a ventilator. They were in a position that a family member didn't want to make the decision. They were then trached, because that's the only way you can sustain ventilator support for a long period of time. Their only option was to go to a facility for care that could sustain that ventilator. The lady never got out of bed. She never woke up. You have to look at what is our moral responsibility to promote a quality of life, and not just say, it's okay, you want to do this. As far as the dollars, Medicare is going to pay for you to access all that treatment. Doesn't matter. So whether you access the treatment or you access hospice, that's your right. And that continues your right even in hospice, because you can revoke your hospice benefit and say, I don't believe I'm dying. I want to go back to the hospital. And all you have to do is say, Adrian, I don't want to be in your program anymore. I'm going to send someone over to say sign out, so that Medicare is going to pay your bill and you're not going to have to eat that bill when you're done in the hospital. So, yeah, very much we are a more cost-effective program. You always have a choice. And that will always be our struggle, because we really have to explain to you why that would be beneficial. And for those of us who do it, it's beneficial because, again, you know, just because we can do it to someone doesn't make it the right choice. And too often, you know, doctors don't want to have that conversation. So, and I can't fault them. Anybody else have a question? Yes, sir. You want the microphone? Say that again. Ah, interesting. So the question, you know, does a stroke make you eligible for hospice? Yes and no. Depends on not the stroke, because you can recover from a stroke. It depends on what the after effects of that stroke is. Because my job as one of the nurses is to write what we call a verbal certification saying that our medical director has deemed the diagnosis in place more than likely would make you a terminal patient. Just the fact that you've had a stroke is not enough. If you've had a stroke and you are no longer able to swallow on a consistent basis, because some people lose partial functioning, some lose all functioning, so you can't swallow, you're presented with choices. One of the biggest choices for that type of concern is you can have a feeding tube. If a family elects, or the patient who's maybe cognizant after the stroke says, you know, I want the feeding tube because I can't eat anymore and I want to maintain my nutritional status, you're not eligible for hospice because the nutritional standpoint will bypass any functional decline. You'll continue to maintain your nutritional status. Now, the question again becomes an ethical one. Was this your decision? Was this decision by a healthcare power of attorney that was related or unrelated to you, who, you know, you hadn't expressed your wishes to and you couldn't say, so they went with that choice? But we talk a lot with our patients about why at end of life tube feeding is not a really good choice. I mean, you can sustain a nutritional level. One of the greatest benefits of eating is that that is a pleasure, and we are looking at eating and drinking as a pleasure. So if you have a stroke and you say, I don't want the feeding tube, and we come in and say, okay, now recognize you're going to choke on occasion, just so everybody knows that's normal. That's not a reason to panic. We expect that to happen. That makes you appropriate for hospice. And again, big educational piece with people. And you know, why it's so important to talk with loved ones about really, you know, what are your wishes at your end of life? Again, I go back to when I did triage for a very long time. You know, a bigger part of my conversations were letting family members know that they didn't have any control over what was going on, that everything that they were doing was right, and that it very much becomes about dignity for the patient. And if the patient's choosing to struggle, that's their fight. They've only got one life, and they're more than entitled to live it however they want. And that's not for me or anyone else to tell them differently, because I'm not going to be the one who's passing. That's for them. You know, that's a tougher one. It depends, because heart failure is a disease process. So in the presence of multiple, but depending on the damage, right? Because having a heart attack and you recover, that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to ever have one again. And one of the things with our heart failure patients, we want to maximize them on all of their cardiac meds, because that's what's going to give them the greatest quality of life. And when those have been maximized and maybe they still exhibit symptomology, they still have shortness of breath, they still have chest pain, then they are eligible for hospice. You're welcome. Anybody else got it? Yes, ma'am.
So I'm an estate planning attorney, and so I was just in a meeting with a client who has maybe like 6 months or something to live. So, but he's still working. So does he contact his employer about his disability insurance, or is it his health insurance that pays for that type of, for hospice?
He's health insurance.
It's health insurance.
Yeah. Exactly how to direct you as far as the disability part, because you know, if he's still working, there's going to come a time when he needs to be, and if he has the benefit, he needs to be on disability, right? Right.
And so, you know, he needs to be talking to his employer, immediately to put all that into place so that when it happens, it's there. Because a lot of our folks scramble when it's already happened. And, you know, as we all typically do, we all have more time than we really know. So, yeah, it'll be his health insurance that would take care of the hospice benefit. However, I'd really be looking at speaking with his human resources about what is his disability insurance. And for caregivers, you know, and I'm not a huge expert on this, you know, if you're going to say you're working, your spouse becomes ill, family medical leave is important. And there's paperwork that's associated with that. And we have social workers that have expertise at taking you through that process. I do so love to hear myself speak. Can I help anybody else with anything else? Any questions? I mean, is anyone interested in or want to share any experiences about end of life? Oh yeah, actually we forgot. Did anybody actually write questions for us, or they made notes to say, "I'm never coming back to this lady again"?
My notes are just for me.
Just for you. Okay, good. Anybody have anything at all? Yes, ma'am. Yeah. Absolutely.
You want to pass it down? Thank
you. When my first husband was diagnosed with leukemia, of course, we fought it as far as we could. But when the doctor said, "I think we should consider hospice," I just said no, because that was so final. And I realize now that that's what we ended up doing. But I think everyone, when you hear hospice, it's the end. But I understand that there's so many benefits from it that it's well worth it. But I just thought maybe other people felt that way too.
But, you know, I do. I speak with people all the time. And, you know, I'm not always certain what their reaction is going to be, because I can't guarantee they're going to like to hear what I have to say. And, you know, my goal is not to offend anybody. And honestly, if someone – and I'm not there to sell them either. My main goal is education, and probably – even a little bit before that, when I'm on the phone with people, I'm listening and I'm picking up what I'm hearing behind what they're saying, because this is an extremely painful time in people's lives. As I said, we have services to offer, but really if people aren't in that place, I can't force them to be there. And I don't want to, because that is not the kind of experience I want to give them. I have had relationships with, and as they said, I work in the office. I do call, so I do see patients in the home on occasion. I have had some really good relationships with our patients because they hear me on the phone. I had a gentleman for a long time, used to call me weekly, and, you know, they know my name because a lot of times I'm the one who's speaking to them first, so that's the name they latch on to, and when they call, they ask for me, and we had a great gig going. He'd call me up, and, "Adrian, I need some oxygen." I said, "Well, you know, let me get that for you," and you wouldn't think you'd get attached, but you do. And when he didn't call, I was sad. And I don't know where that came from, but it's genuine. So, anyways.
See how compassionate we are?
Yeah. I should give it back to Charlie for a while.
Thank you, man. You're welcome.
Well, what one of the things that I wanted to say is that this is kind of one of those because it truly is a business and a service at the same time, but it's one of those things that sometimes you kind of have a story about. You know, you tell someone your experience who then tells someone who then tells someone else, and hopefully it's a good experience. You know, I've been in healthcare myself for a long time, and one of the reasons I got into healthcare was because I have a 20, now 3-year-old brother who's autistic. And I was trying to figure out, you know, well, hey, I want to learn a little bit more about this disorder. I want to figure out how can I help him? How can I help others? And that's where things kind of started for me. And the hospice light was turned on for me years ago when my grandmother went through it. But I was, what, a teenager then? I really didn't understand it. I really didn't understand a lot of things when I was a teenager. But a few years ago, I used to work for IU Health, and I had an uncle that came into the hospital with what he thought was just a really bad cold. Hey, maybe I've got some pneumonia or something like that. And long story short, he never left the hospital. And he came in, and they said, hey, you know, Charlie and family, you know, he's got pneumonia. And, you know, his body overall just kind of took a turn for the worse. And the family kind of looked to me and said, hey, you know, you're a social worker. You tell us what to do. I'm like, I don't know. You know, this is a family decision. But I'll tell you what really helped guide us along during that time was that physician, as Adrian mentioned, being very open and very honest with us and saying, this is what you can do. This is probably what's going to make things worse. At the end of the day, it's your choice. But what do you really want to do? What did he want if he was ever going to have something like this happen? And that was very powerful because it was nice to have a doctor that was upfront, compassionate, but giving us the facts at the same time. You know, I mean, let's be honest. Sometimes our doctors, they don't really do that. They're not always honest with us and saying, this is what you've got going on. This is what the result's going to be. Sometimes they kind of hide behind it. And when I talk to a lot of the physicians, that's what they'll say, Charlie, I don't know how to have this conversation. I don't know what to say. I don't want to offend anyone. You know, there's different cultural beliefs, spiritual beliefs. There's, you know, I mean, there's so many different factors that goes into a decision like this. But it was nice to have him there, guide us through that. And then we sat down as a family and we said, okay, he's in the hospital. We're not at a point where we can take him home. Clinically, he's not stable to go to any kind of nursing facility, anything like that. So we'll have to stay at Methodist Hospital. And the hospice team came in, and he was able to stay with us for 3 weeks. And I tell you that during that 3 weeks, there were so much laughter, so many memories that were shared. The team was great at that hospital. And from the nurses to the social workers to the doctors to the chaplains that came up that prayed with us. And I know this is something we kind of touched on a little earlier, but one of the things that really helped us get through this difficult time was having those folks on the bereavement team come in afterwards, sending flowers to the funeral, showing up at the funeral, calling us, how are you guys doing? What is it that you need? How can we help? We felt like, okay, they really are holding our hand. We expected them to leave and just go about their business and go and work with some other patient. And they're still, hey, what is it that we can do to help you? We know this is difficult. It was really important to the young people in our family that really didn't understand anything about death. They didn't know how to grieve. But we were able to have someone help there to do that. So the reason why I share that story with you because, you know, you're in sitting down in front of someone who's been through it personally, you know, with his own family members, and that sometimes help when I'm out here talking to people trying to deliver that message. And I know that it's not easy. It's not an easy thing to talk about. But then it kind of takes us back to what we talked about in the beginning, which was that advanced care planning, making sure you take that time with your family, sit down, talk about your wishes. Trust me, it's going to make things a lot easier because tomorrow's not promised to us, no matter how much faith we have in God. And what you don't want to do is to not have that discussion with your loved ones, and then they're at the bedside trying to scramble and figure out, okay, now what do we do? That really just causes so much more stress to the situation. And even though we do a good job of managing that stress, it would be a lot easier if that conversation was already had. So what other questions you fine folks have for us this evening? We did that good? Was this helpful? I hope it was. I know there was a lot of information. You know, it's not something that you can get all at one time. One of the things that Adrienne does is, you know, she may have a conversation with a family or with a physician or with someone at a nursing facility maybe 3 or 4 times before they actually sign up to use this benefit, because she's walking them through that process. She's checking on them to see if there's been anything that's changed. So the point I'm getting at is that it is such a complex service that you can't always get your questions answered at one time in one sitting. If you gathered the information when you were coming in, we had a couple of brochures. There's a sort of one page that kind of gives you an outline of our services. And then on the back of that, there's a map that actually shows you our coverage area. When people think of our service line, they think we're only on the south side. No, that's not true. We actually service 7 counties. And like Adrienne said, that's in that home, wherever that may be. That could be hospital. That could be at their home. It could be an aunt's house. It could be in a nursing facility. It could be in assisted living. And then the other thing is a brochure, which I think is a, what do you call it, a trifold? Is that what it is? Or fourfold, something like that? Which actually kind of talks about our team and some of the things that Adrienne talked about today. There's a 1-800 number. And there's also 528-2092, which actually comes directly to our office. I wish that we had 12 Adriennes, but if you have questions, if you have concerns, if you just want to know, okay, I forget, Charlie, everything you guys said, give us a call. It may not be Adrienne. It could be me. It could be Carla. We'll make sure that we get you directed to the right place. Because, again, we just want to inform you so that you know, rather you don't know. Does that make sense? Okay. Well, thank you, Pastor Hayes.
So a lot of people purchase additional insurance to cover things that maybe Medicare doesn't cover. And I'm trying to think some of the managed care plans, that type of thing. So hospice benefit reverts back to traditional Medicare. So if you have some type of supplemental to cover, say, medications that would not necessarily be covered by traditional Medicare, it's not the supplemental policy, it is your traditional Medicare that will pay for the hospice benefit. And I probably didn't make that very clear. The other part of that is when, you know, we are bringing you on service for a terminal diagnosis, you have every right to continue using medications that are for disease processes that have really nothing to do with what's terminally wrong with you. So if I have a patient that has congestive heart failure, the hospice benefit says we're going to manage your congestive heart failure and we're going to pay for any of the medications related to that. If in addition you are a diabetic, Hospice, because of Medicare regulations, we can't provide medications that are unrelated to the diagnosis, but your Medicare and your supplemental insurances, they do not prevent you from getting those medicines. So if I get a patient coming out of the hospital and looking at whatever the doctors have ordered going forward, and this is what we're, say, starting with, you know, hospice is going to take care of those things that are related. So if it's a cancer patient, you know, we're looking at pain management, we're looking at, depending on where that cancer is, if there's metastasis to the lung, we're looking at things like nebulizers, we're providing oxygen a lot of times, we're, you know, looking at things that make people comfortable. If steroids are needed, then, you know, that's covered. It's not like we bring you on hospice and you don't get to take any medicines anymore. That's not the case, because you can continue to get your diabetes medicines and everything else that's not related to that terminal diagnosis the same way you always have. The only difference is, you know, we're happy, since we're seeing you in the home, to, you know, be trying to help make those adjustments rather than having you have to go to doctor's appointments. You're not limited to not seeing physicians that are seeing you for concerns that have nothing to do with your hospice diagnosis. It's just those things that are related to hospice is what we're managing. And something else that came to mind, you know, one of the things I said was that you have to be done with active treatment. Well, there's always varying degrees of what is considered treatment. You know, some people do need an occasional blood transfusion. Mostly at end of life, we really try to avoid IV fluids because of the potential dangers with increased secretions, and we do a lot of education. Those type of treatment options are looked at on a case-by-case basis. It's not we do this or we don't do this. That is something that's discussed, and it's brought before what we call our interdisciplinary group, and it's the physicians, the nurses, and it's made up of the social workers, the volunteer coordinator, chaplain. It's not only case managers, and I know we kind of touched on, you know, your nurse. They call those nurses case managers because they're managing your care and trying to get you the best, sort of the optimum function that they can for you, and coordinating kind of all aspects, be that, you know, home health aid services, social services, whatever you need. Did that answer your question? Yes. Yeah. No, I thank you, because that is very important. Very important. And, you know, one of the things in hospice, you know, we look at pain management as being one of our quality measures. I mean, because we're always asked to be accountable. So within 48 hours of bringing someone on service, our mandate is to have their pain at a manageable level. Our first choice is oral, if people are swallowing. We look at supplementing that with things like fentanyl patches, which are absorbed through the skin, and then transitioning to, if it's really severe pain, sometimes we use what are called CAD pumps, and they're basically drip medication delivered through a small needle under the skin.
and really very effective for pain control. I'll tell you, the greater concern that we see on a frequent basis, it's not pain, because pain, for the most part, kind of creeps up on you. It's the air hunger issues. And some of the medicines that we use traditionally are morphine. And there's a lot of fear about morphine, and we use medicines in very small doses. And they call it titrating for comfort. And in hospice, because as people decline, one of the things that happens is they lose the ability to swallow. So when I talked about we like to be able to use our standing orders, morphine as an oral concentrate is one of our standing orders, and that's a medicine that is a very small volume that we give in the mouth, but it's absorbed through the mucous membrane, so people don't have to swallow it. And what we want to do is have that available, because we know when people are declining that eventually that swallowing is going to be lost, and we want to be able to respond to that, because honestly, some people can change in as little as 6 hours and go from a place where they were very functioning to they're not anymore. And to put medicines in a home, it takes about 4 hours. So think about that in terms of you maybe haven't recognized it immediately, and then it's going to take me that long. So that's one of the things we really strive to do, is get that stuff in place in case, because we know that that in case is going to come.
I know you said that Medicare pays for hospice.
Yes. So it reverts back. So Medicare picks up the hospice benefit.
Oh, they do.
They do. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's I think exactly what Pastor Hayes was trying to get to. In our language, it reverts back to your original Medicare benefit,
so you
and that's
have
how.
To make sure you select something else that
no. No, and again, I think that has more to do with the fact that it's more cost effective to look after people in their homes than it is to bring them into the hospital. And so, you know, the push going forward in our lifetime is going to be coming out of hospitals and going into the community. I thought someone else had a question. Maybe it got answered. So.
Can you explain to them, we get a lot of questions about why can't they have IVs?
Mm-hmm.
Because they think people are going to they think they're thirsty.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I believe I have an ally in the crowd. So hydration at end of life. You know, first tenet, do no harm. Well, I'm healthy, and I have decent cardiac status, so I get an IV, and that fluid is going to go through my body. It's going to get pumped from my heart into my blood system. It's going to go down to my feet. It's going to come back to my heart. It's going to go through my lungs. It's just going to continue on. It's going to rehydrate me. You get a fragile, critically ill, elder person, and not necessarily elder, but person at end of life. What's happening is their body is slowly shutting down. They don't have the kind of heart that it takes to pump that fluid. They don't have the vascular system that it takes to circulate that fluid. They don't have the nutritional status that it takes to get that fluid to do some use. They don't have the kidneys that are going to effectively pass that fluid. And so the danger of doing that at end of life is that you're going to drown someone. And that's kind of almost like a vulgar way to put it. But basically, what goes in has to go somewhere. In a healthy person, they pass it by urinating. In a person who is not healthy, that fluid goes out into the tissues, it backs up into the lungs, and it actually causes greater distress. You have an increase in secretions. One of the things at end of life that we put into place is a way to decrease those secretions, because when people are failing, it's not actually the fluid per se that you're hearing that you could suction out of them. It's just fluid that's sitting there. They're not strong enough to cough. It's not going to come out even if they could. You couldn't suction it out. And it becomes loud. And so in hospice, we treat that. They call it a rattle, a death rattle. We treat it not because it bothers the patient, because usually when that's going on, they're kind of beyond a point where they're really cognizant. It's very hard for caregivers to listen to. And so our recommendation is usually, by trying to educate, that yes, in a healthy person, and I understand where you're coming from saying that this would be a good idea because this is what you've seen to be of benefit, but I'm telling you as your nurse, I'm afraid to do that, because then what do we do if we can't get rid of that fluid? And I honestly, I've had people hang up on me multiple times, unfortunately, because they don't want to hear that. And I really don't want to tell them that, except that it scares me that, you know, if I don't do my job, then we're going to hurt somebody. So, anybody else have anything? Yes, ma'am. Oh, to get us into your house, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, it depends. Like I said, I have to have an order. And so that, like I said, it comes from the doctor. I have an order. Once I have an order, so I have something to work with, I schedule a nurse to come out. We really try and prevent emergent calls, because we're really not set up to be emergent in any way. Again, it takes, from the time that I have someone's consent to actually do treatment, I mean, you're looking at a four-hour window for bringing narcotics or that kind of management into the home. I do get calls, and I have great difficulty because I don't want to say, you know, this isn't a good idea. People really, they don't want to go back to the hospital. And kind of where we've gone with that is, you know, this is what I can offer. But, I mean, from the time of a referral to get somebody into the home to actually be effective, you're talking about 8 hours probably where there would be something in place. And that's best case scenario. And that's kind of throwing all of our workforce away from everything else we're doing to treat an emergent thing. And I really try not to do that because it's not maybe the best for the patient or the family. So. Y'all tired of listening to me yet? You know? Anybody have anything else? I haven't scared them yet.
Well, if you don't have any other questions, again, we really thank you for coming out tonight and listening to us for the last hour and a half. We really appreciate your questions as well. That's really helpful for us. I know it feel like it took you guys a little bit to get kind of warmed up to us, and that's okay. We understand. But like I say, this is a difficult conversation, difficult subject to have. If for some reason you were a little shy and you didn't want to raise your hand, but you got a question, like I say, our number is on there, or you can come and approach us individually afterwards, just so that we can make sure that you know as much as you can know. Again, thank you, and thank you, Pastor Hayes, for having us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Charlie. This has been enlightening. And I know it got a little bit long, but, you know, anything worthwhile is going to take some time to get educated about, because you never know what tomorrow is going to bring. I see so much of this in my ministry here and have in the past years. And you have done an admirable thing by coming tonight to get educated about what it would be like if you or one of your family members needed to see is this a time that we need to talk about hospice or end-of-life care? This was very, very important, and I thank you for your attention and for your coming out, and I want to thank the St. Francis Group so very much. You have done an admirable job. If you do have questions, you can approach Charlie or any one of the team here. And I think we're going to just go ahead and dismiss tonight. But again, I just can't thank you enough for coming out. You've made my day. Okay. Thank you.